eco-socialist writer and editor Ian Angus, who I interviewed this morning, and he's the online editor of Climate and Capitalism.
It's not going to be a great shock to our audience that the idea that we can't solve the ecological crisis or even make major strides towards it under capitalism. But what's the main reasons for that from your point of view?
Well, there are, in fact, many reasons, but I think the simplest one is that capitalism as an economic system simply has to grow or die. A corporation isn't constantly expanding its capital, it's contracting. Uh-huh. And to the extent that the system doesn't expand its capital, it goes backwards. So the system is always looking for ways to expand production, to expand consumption, and so on. And so any process that involves reducing the impact on the environment is alien to capitalism. And as I'm arguing in my new book, Facing the Anthropocene, key to that has been for about 200 years a dependence on fossil fuels, which isn't just some kind of overlay on capitalism, not just something you could chuck aside, but actually fundamental to how every single part of the system works. And so, I mean, it isn't even a function of, well, there's a big fossil fuel lobby. It's a function of every corporation of every kind is dependent on the continued use of fossil fuels. Because capitalism is not only a need to grow, but a need to grow rapidly, that it's always got a short-term perspective, a kind of long-term planning that will be essential to get out of fossil fuels and into a different kind of energy environment, is simply outside the ken of the capitalist system.
Okay, well, we'll certainly explore that a little bit later, because that's been it's a major theme of our program, talking about renewables and fossil fuels and the degree to which the fossil fuel industry is tenacious in holding on to its position, or at least trying to. But let's go back a couple of steps. The imperative to growth in capitalism, obviously, you're arguing that's inherent. So are you saying that the capitalist state, which tends to at times try and embody the collective interest of capitalists, is still under that system incapable of imposing some sort of, if not long-term, medium-term balance, if you like, on the system, some way of looking after the system as a whole, even against the interests of particular capitalists?
Yeah, one of the interesting things about the capitalist state is it does, you know, try to perform that function. It's one of its roles is to act as the sort of general interest of the corporations, as opposed to the specific interest of individual corporations. But once again, it is an interest which is viewed in very short term. It's viewed in terms of, you ever get the meeting of the G20, which is all the meeting of the big governments together, they'll always issue a statement in which the most frequent word is growth. There's a constant view that the only way to deal with anything is to continually grow. And governments have, I mean, I don't think it's any accident, I don't think it's any, just failure of will, that governments from Canada to Australia to France view expanding production, constantly growing, as the key to what they have to do on behalf of the individual corporations, is to do whatever policies that takes. In Canada, where I live, for example, we have a prime minister right now who makes a very good show of talking environmental questions. He's much better than our previous prime minister on that. He signed the Paris Agreement. He makes great speeches about being green and converting to renewables, and yet he then says the way we're going to convert to renewables is by expanding our production on the tar sands, and that will generate the revenue in order to make the economy capable of becoming green. It's just
One of the most environmentally destructive forms of fossil fuel there is.
Yes, and it's, but the thing is that it is a central component of the Canadian capitalist economy, and in order to stop that, I mean, it's not simply a matter of saying, well, we're going to go to green fuels, because you've got decades of transition there under any circumstances. I mean, starting points are going to have to be, we stop doing some things. We stop having a military, which is the largest use of fossil fuels there is. We stop advertising, for example. All of the things that this system does that actually produce no benefit, except in the sense that they generate profit. I mean, our starting point actually is to, when people say we have to cut back, that doesn't mean that individuals have to cut back, but it does mean there's big chunks of the economy that simply are not viable and never will be from an environmental point of view. But from a capitalist point of view, they generate profit and thus are, you know, when they say sustainable, they usually mean sustainable capitalism.
Yeah.
That capitalism will be sustained under these changes.
Which is the meaning of that term, sustainable development, doesn't it? I mean, it means sustainable expansion.
Exactly.
And of course, it's completely contradictory. Okay, we in Australia, as I'm sure in Canada and the US and around the world, in recent years, since Occupy, have been focusing very much on the 1%, the issue of corporate taxation, of multinational dodging of taxes, of all the elements in which is leading to greater and greater inequality in incomes, in capacity to live even in our world. But of course, a lot of the main parts of the liberal left tend to focus on individual capitalists or individual companies and talks about greed as the issue. Now, that is somewhat misleading, isn't it?
Well, it's not that greed, I mean, it's misleading in the sense that it's not the fundamental question. It's not that greed isn't a problem. And we have a system that actually rewards greed.
Mm.
If you, any psychologist will tell you, if you set up a system in a school that rewards certain things, people will do those things, as opposed to other activities they might do. Well, similarly in the system, we've got a system that rewards greed. And so the result is you do tend to get the greedy in charge, and the greedy do get the rewards. But the question you then have to ask is, why does this system reward greed?
Mm.
And once again, you get back to the fact that capitalism is based on return on capital. I've got money, I want to invest it. I'm not going to invest it in something that is not going to bring me back more money than I put in. There would be no point.
Yeah,
I could keep it in my sock for that, or put it in a bank account, you know, even at 1% interest, if it's going to, I don't want to lose money. And the whole economy is that writ large, where you are they are constantly, you make a profit. It does, that profit, unlike, say, in feudalism, where the excess food that was produced was basically eaten in great huge feasts by the wealthy, and you used up the whole surplus above what ordinary people need, we're in a system where their surplus is so great that it's beyond anybody's ability to consume it. So it just constantly gets plowed back into the system and grows again. It goes back into the system and grows. I was just reading Michael Yates's new book, The Great Inequality, and he just talks about how Bill Gates leaves his money to his children. Those children could sleep through the rest of their lives, and they would be vastly richer when they woke up, because the money just keeps growing, and it's impossible to consume it.
That it's not exactly a rocket science to keep on making money when you've got that amount of money.
Well, that's not to say that capitalists always make money or that the capital always grows. In fact, one of the things we do see, you know, every decade or so, is the system basically overreaches itself and you get a sudden contraction. And when you talk about, you know, the people who refer to degrowth as our goal, well, when you actually see degrowth in a capitalist system, what you see is hundreds of thousands of people thrown out of work, economies collapsing, and so on, because degrowth in capitalism is entirely a negative phenomenon.
Mm. Now, to get back to the point you made earlier about fossil fuels and its central role, there's several puzzling aspects to the current situation with fossil fuels globally. We, despite the fact we talked some time ago about peak oil, mm-hmm. and the notion of the cheap extraction being nearly over, and therefore oil becoming more and more expensive, that's not been the pattern of the last year or so. What do you see as the reason for that, and how does that relate to what you said earlier about the central role of fossil fuels?
Well, once again, as you say, many people were talking about peak oil. You don't hear too much about that anymore.
Mm.
But the view was that from a physical point of view, with the technology that existed at the time, oil was going to start. The oil production was going to start to decline. What that whole argument missed was the economic role of oil. And then oil is so vital to the system, its price can go up very substantially without losing without reducing consumption, without corporations no longer using it. So what happened when we did in fact hit peak oil under old technology was simply the massive investment in new technology to get shale gas, to get fracked oil, to get in Canada tar sands oil, sources of oil that simply were not economical 20 years ago, become economical when the price goes up. Because for capitalism, price is always the decisive question. Mm. You know, can you make money on it? And so long as, like we're right now seeing in Canada, for example, where the worldwide price of oil has gone down, and the result is the tar sands industry is in deep trouble. Yeah. Because it's now reached the point where it costs more to produce oil than they can, for them to produce it than they can sell it for. So they're closing down, and a lot of people are being thrown out of work. The oil price will undoubtedly go up again, and the tar sands will open up again.
But, I mean, fossil fuels of any type need a lot of investment in infrastructure of various kinds, in roads, in mines, in the mining equipment, in CSG, etc. And obviously in pipelines. That's been an important part of the whole question of replacing fossil fuel by renewables, that the companies themselves tend to try very hard to impose the cost of their fixed capital, their infrastructure, etc., on everyone else through rising fossil fuel, rising fuel bills, etc. I presume that's a phenomenon in Canada as well.
Well, it certainly is, and it's one of the things we're seeing now. There's a proposal in Canada for what's called the Energy East pipeline, which would basically take tar sands oil from Alberta, which is almost on the west coast, not quite, all the way to the Atlantic Ocean, 3,500 miles away, and carry 1.5 million barrels a day over 2,000 lakes and rivers, and just an incredibly stupid project from an environmental point of view. And also from if you bleed seriously the claims of our politicians and so on that they want to go green and so on, you have to say, why would anybody be approving a project that involves between $17 and $20 billion in infrastructure investment? Because once that investment is made, the corporations that built those pipelines are going to want to get their return for as long as possible. Mm. That sort of commits you to continuing to pump oil for decades to come. So, I mean, that's really, that structure affects directly the fossil fuel industry. But then you add on all of the industries that depend on that. The automobile industry is an obvious one, of course. But even things like plastics, which is the third largest manufacturing function in North America, entirely based on oil as its source material. Mm. But you could go even beyond that. Places that make detergent, or places that make toothpaste, or places that make hand cream. Ultimately, their plants are driven by fossil fuels.
Obviously, there's a massive input of the tar sands into climate change exacerbation. But what about the pipelines themselves? We know that in the developing world, for instance, Nigerian Delta, there's massive leaks and problems, both ecological and human-based, from those leaks, explosions, fires, etc. Is that the case in a developed country like Canada as well, that there are significant problems with the actual pipeline?
Not as severe as you would find in Nigeria, where the oil companies can get away with completely slipshod methods, and where there is so much oil there that they can waste enormous amounts of it. Mm. In fact, TransCanada, who are trying to build the Energy East pipeline, have spent an enormous amount of money trying to convince the public that they have enormous safety systems built in. But when you look at their actual record, TransCanada is a pipeline that also goes into the States, in which they predicted, you know, there would be no more than one leak every 20 years. And in the first 6 months, there were about 15, some of them small, some of them large. And one of the difficulties with pipelines is when you do have, you know, even a pipeline with the most sophisticated leak detection equipment, if you're pumping, you know, 1 million barrels a day, you can detect a leak and turn things off. And between those two times, you've got hundreds of thousands of barrels spilling out. It just cannot be done instantly. We have had the specific pipeline that they want to use for this is actually already in use for natural gas. And that pipeline exploded a few years ago in a fairly remote area, and it was a good 12 hours before they even realized it.
Yeah.
This is despite their claim of highly sophisticated detection equipment, you know?
Mm. Mm.
And when you look at some of the leaks there have been recently, there was recently a major leak in North Dakota of an American pipeline, which is actually carrying Canadian oil. And again, for all the talk about sophisticated detection equipment, the way this leak was found was a farmer happened to be out in his field and noticed that the soil was looking unusually dark and mucky and reported that there seemed to be oil leaking. And the oil company hadn't noticed.
No. Okay, to turn to CSG, fracking, that's a live issue in Australia at present. It's some states ban it, some states allow it, and in those states where it is, like Queensland, it causes major problems, as it does around the world, as we know. Do you think the CSG industry is still going to be significant in the future, or is it becoming technology which is no longer viable?
That's one of those things that's very hard to predict. I mean, again, it's one of those things like when we were talking about peak oil. With the existing technology, what you call CSG, what I'd call fracking, is going to hit a wall in the relative near future, 10 years or so, because there is not actually that much oil down in the shale compared with traditional oil sources or gas sources. But they constantly work on new technology. And so often when things are declared, you know, when traditional wells have been closed, that hasn't meant all the oil is gone. It's meant all the oil we can get out economically is gone.
Mm.
And certainly I think you will continue to see substantial investment in getting the oil down to the last drop. And of course the climate danger to that is that if we burn all of the oil that is known to exist, it's goodbye climate.
Yeah, yeah. And I did switch to the other side of things with renewables, and obviously I don't include nuclear in that. We're having a big nuclear debate in this state, but wind and solar in particular. We're living in a state that is planning to have about 50% of its energy generated by renewables in about the next 15 to 20 years. Now, why cannot renewables, which are obviously still going to be operating under a capitalist system, why cannot that make a major contribution to stopping climate change by any means, but retarding it under a capitalist system?
Well, it can. I mean, it's certainly obvious that one should support any move you can to stop pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But you also have to bear in mind that almost all renewables have other environmental costs. The cost of building solar panels is, you know, it is not environmentally free. You still have to dig out all kinds of minerals and throw to build those things.
Hmm.
So there's a cost involved in that, and a full conversion to renewables would actually involve, in the short term, a massive increase in the use of non-renewables because you need the energy to build those things. Again, as I say, I'm certainly in favor of any moves that can be made under capitalism. The other problem with it is the time it will take. The Paris Agreement, for all its weaknesses, does fairly accurately say we've got to start rapidly declining fossil fuel use within the next couple of years. And I haven't seen any plan from any company, any country, that involves the level of reduction you'd need. Well, let me take that back. I believe Cuba has set a goal, and there's a couple of other the island states, and I apologize to all of them for not remembering their names, that have those programs. But if you look at what's going on in any of the major capitalist countries, their programs involve expansion in greenhouse gases for a long time to come. They just some of the plans they've announced just depend on magic.
Mm.
You have to, if you look at the core plans that came out of most of the big countries, and the Paris Agreement said by 2050 we're supposed to start reducing overall. Well, what they're saying is that by 2020 there will be by 2050, more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than can be permitted if they want to meet the 2-degree limit. And so what they're betting on is that somewhere around 2150, somebody will invent a technology that takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere.
Yeah.
No such technology exists, and no technology is likely to exist that can be scaled up in the time they're talking about. The simple fact is that radical reduction in greenhouse gas emissions would involve serious reduction in capitalist economy on a level that capitalists generally will not accept. I mean, the only case we have had of a major capitalist country or any major country actually radically reducing its greenhouse gas emissions was the former Soviet Union, whose economy completely collapsed in the early 90s. And that was the way they reduced emissions, by basically everybody's jobs vanishing and a lot of people dying young.
Yeah. Just to take a counter argument for a minute, some people have pointed to the fact that in crisis situations like major wars, capitalist states have taken over running or coordinating significant parts of the economy and have significantly reduced costs and inefficiency and even put profits temporarily in some areas at the beck and call of production. But of course, the key issue there is it doesn't reduce growth. It just switches growth to another area.
In addition, there's actually, I have a whole chapter in my Facing the Anthropocene book talking about World War II as the example, and particularly the United States, which is always pointed to, where they switched to a war economy, stopped making cars, started making tanks so fast. But when you actually look what happened, the companies that profited out of that, overwhelmingly the fossil fuel companies did very well at it. They made enormous profits. In the case of the United States, they actually had all of the major contracts that went for building more materials were done on a cost-plus basis, which basically meant guaranteed profit.
Yeah.
And those companies came out of the war bigger than they went in. And what we're talking, when I do hear people say, let's do a World War II-style program, and certainly sounds like a great idea. The problem is a World War II-style program involved pumping tax money into car manufacturers to make weapons, into oil companies to produce higher tech, higher octane fuel for jets, and so on. And what we're saying now is going to be necessary is taking the wealth away from oil companies, away from major corporations, and that has never been done.